Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, if there's one thing a lot of my listening audience in Florida have in common with my listeners in the southern Appalachian region, it's an appreciation for the Blue Ridge Mountains of western North Carolina, especially in the heat of summer. And if there's one particular Blue Ridge Mountain that most of them would recognize, it's Grandfather Mountain. It's not the tallest mountain in the east or even in the Blue Ridge, but it is the biggest and by far the most distinctive in several different ways. My guest this week is author and professional outdoorsman Randy Johnson, who's produced a wonderful book about this landmark called Grandfather Mountain, The History and Guide to an Appalachian Icon. Welcome, Randy.
Great to be with you, Court.
Nice to have you with us. And I say that you produced the book because you didn't just write this book. You also filled it with pictures and maps and lots of other illustrations, including many great photos that you took yourself over the years. It's a really comprehensive treatment of everything about the mountain from geologic times to the present. I'd say kind of halfway between a textbook and a coffee table display book, and it is really kind of both those in a way. I gather you've dedicated most of your adult life to this mountain in one way or another, Randy, so your book is really a labor of love.
Grandfather Mountain is a peak that's been towering on my horizon pretty much my entire life. It's a spectacular place. I discovered it in my youth when I was searching for the coldest, snowiest mountain in the South to climb. And, you know, I eventually ended up living right on the flank of Grandfather Mountain and caring a lot about its preservation. And it's a transcendent part of my entire life at this point.
Did you fall in love right away when you saw the mountain?
I think I did. I mean, you call me an outdoorsman. I mean, I'm a lover of mountains. And when people think of mountains, they think of spectacular views and rugged, rocky, alpine places. And I was searching for the most spectacular summit in the entire South. And when I saw Grandfather and climbed ladders up the cliff faces on the mountain and found myself looking down on a vertical mile drop off to the Piedmont, I knew it was probably the most spectacular mountain in the South. And all the study I've given it, I think, has pretty much proven that to me.
Yeah, I mentioned that it's not the tallest, but you just mentioned the drop-off. And I think, you know, you make a point a couple times in your book about the fact that it appears to be the largest because the approach to the mountain is relatively low. And then, you know, go ahead and describe that. I mean, the mountain itself stands more starkly against its surroundings than other tall mountains do.
It really does. And think about this for a minute. A mountain is really only perceived to be high based on how far above its bottom, its base, that it rises. So when you're driving in the Piedmont of North Carolina and you look up, you know, and you can see Grandfather Mountain, it is a vertical mile above you. And that kind of elevation change is much more comparable to the Rocky Mountains than it is to the Appalachians. So, you know, when I looked down and when Andre Michaud, the famous explorer, looked down in 1794, when he first climbed the mountain, no wonder he thought it was the tallest mountain in all North America, He wrote in his diary, because he'd never seen a higher mountain than that. And you can estimate, if you had a lot of experience, just how high you are. And both he and I looked down and, you know, were pretty much mightily impressed, I'll tell you.
You know, most people who've seen Grandfather Mountain realize that its name comes from the fact that its profile resembles an old man's face. But what I didn't know is that there are actually four different human-like faces visible on the mountain from different directions. Can I talk about that for just a minute?
That really is a fascinating thing. I mean, you know, we all know that the old man of the mountains in New Hampshire is a famous profile face. Now, sadly, that rock formation fell, you know, probably 15 years ago. But that's unlikely to happen on Grandfather, because instead of having one face of an old man, Grandfather indeed does have four. And in fact, I mean, four that are arguably very identifiable, but some people have claimed to have seen more. You know, there may be more, but one thing I find fascinating is that even the profile that most people think is, quote, the real profile of the mountain is wrong. Most people don't pick out the profile that actually gave the mountain its name. And that's very easily visible from one of Grandfather Mountain's most popular trails called the Profile Trail.
And you've got a lot of pictures of the different angles and profiles of Grandfather Mountain in your book. So the one that's like, that's horizontal, that's facing the sky and that has the big chin and the big nose and the big forehead, you're saying that's not the primary one, or that is?
that is not the primary one. You just made a good point there. You said the chin. Well, when you're looking at that profile that's reclining backward, if you do look all the way down to the chin, or what some people call the beard, zero in on that chin or that beard, and you will see that the western side of that particular rock formation is identical to a human face. It is, in microcosm, it is almost a perfect human face. And that, when snow and ice blast the mountain, that is the grandfather of Grandfather Mountain fame.
That's wild. You know, I first visited Grandfather Mountain when I was little. Like a lot of Miamians, we would come north, come to the western North Carolina mountains in the summer, right? You know, my mom and brothers and I. So I was maybe 6 or 7 years old when I first climbed Grandfather Mountain, or climbed up the trails, or part of it anyway. And I assumed it was like all the other mountains around it, geologically, only bigger. But it's not. It's geologically different. So you describe that in the first part of your book where you're talking about the geology. So why don't you describe that to us here?
Well, the interesting thing about Grandfather is that it's called a window. It's Grandfather Mountain Window, which means this is a particularly unique geological opening in the Earth's crust. The general southern Appalachians around us here, you know, are pretty old rock. But Grandfather Mountain is a prominent collection of very young rocks in this area south of Boone. And what has happened is when the continents collided and earth and rock and debris was forced up over Grandfather Mountain, the underlying young rocks were so rugged that the general topography above that eroded away and exposed all those younger rocks. And that really hasn't happened anywhere else. So Grandfather Mountain's ruggedness, its dramatic cragginess, and also the Linville Gorge's ruggedness are both exposed in the Grandfather Mountain window. It is a unique, it does offer a unique view of just how grand the Appalachians used to be, and the fact that Grandfather Mountain still has a lot of that grandeur that you can see.
And so that window you described is really kind of a rift in the Earth's crust, I guess, that some different rocks are thrust up through. And you make the point in your book that it kind of resembles more the granite mountains, even though it's not granite, but more the mountains of like Vermont or somewhere. You know, it's a different type of mountain than is common around western North Carolina.
Well, you know what's fascinating about what you just said is that why are the New England Appalachians so rocky? Part of the reason is the glaciers. The ice sheets scoured all of that soil and everything off those mountains, and they are very rocky and alpine. And that didn't happen at Grandfather Mountain. All of that other rock eroded away, exposing a mountain that has a lot more similarities to mountains in New England. I've often found this fascinating, too, that before the Great Smoky Mountains were named a national park and before Shenandoah became a national park, the earliest discussion about a national park in the mountains of the South was the Linville Gorge and Grandfather Mountain. Not because they're just so close, but because they share a rugged grandeur that we still have today.
And it's also a huge mountain. It's not just one peak like you think of most mountains as being, oh, there's such and such mountain, right? But it's a long stretch of mountainous terrain that's all really one mountain, right?
It is. It's a monolithic mountain. It's a, I'm trying to think of the geological term, but it's escaping me now. But Grandfather Mountain is huge. You can be way off the side of the mountain down toward the Piedmont and be hiking a trail and get to a rocky viewpoint. And essentially, you're still on Grandfather Mountain. It rises directly out of a huge amount of terrain. And in fact, when you're driving around the Boone area or when you're driving by Blowing Rock, you're still on Grandfather Mountain, even though you're looking up at the peak and think that's the mountain. Well, you're still on it, really.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Randy Johnson, who is a travel writer and the author of a big, beautiful new book called Grandfather Mountain, The History and Guide to an Appalachian Icon. So let's talk, Randy, for a while about the, we've talked about the geology of the mountain, but let's talk about the human interactions with it. To go back more to the beginning, how did Native Americans view the mountain? Do we have any idea?
Many people ask me that, and I think there's this assumption that there were Cherokee villages in the valley around the mountain, and the Native Americans looked up and had a lot of interaction with Grandfather. But believe it or not, they did not. There were hunting parties that would go past the mountain, and that's the term scientists always use. They would go by the mountain on hunting forays, but it was just too cold in the high mountains. They couldn't grow crops. The Cherokee were a valley people, and no doubt the Native Americans noticed the faces of the mountain or whatever, but there was no significant Native American presence anywhere near the mountain here, much less on it, even though one of the caves on the mountaintop is named Indian House Cave. It's very unlikely that it was any kind of a Native American ritual site.
Yeah, it's interesting. You would have thought they would have viewed it as kind of revered it as some sort of holy site or something just because of the human faces on it. But maybe they did, and there's no record left of that. Who knows? You know.
No, that's probably the case. And in fact, there is a lot of speculation that Grandfather was considered a power mountain to the Native Americans, and that maybe they did some rituals high up on the mountain so that they could take some of the power of Grandfather with them. But there's no documentation of anything like that.
You have a chapter in your book about the early explorers of the mountain and the early scientists who studied it. You mentioned one named André Michaud. Give us a quick rundown, Randy, of who came and went, and when, in the early days of white settlement of the region, did they already know that it was a special mountain?
Well, the list of early explorers and scientists is a long one. And like I said, you can see the mountain from a long way off. And actually, Daniel Boone was one of those people who likely climbed the mountain. And my guess is that Boone literally was attracted on his way west, living in the Yadkin Valley area of North Carolina near Wilkesboro. I think he looked up and saw Grandfather, and he had a love for high, far seeing places, as it's been put. And I think when he looked west and saw Grandfather, that mountain, the desire to stand on it, might very well have led him there. So word about the mountain got out, and the list of scientists is a long one. André Michaud, of course, had that experience on top of the mountain where he thought he was on the highest mountain in all Eastern America. And Elisha Mitchell, the fellow who died on Mount Mitchell, and the mountain was named after, Elisha Mitchell made a pilgrimage to Grandfather as well. There's just an amazing number of people, including, ultimately, the very early adventurers who decided that, you know, this was toward the late 1800s. You know, the people down in the flatlands were beginning to discover that, hey, it's cool up there in the mountains. Maybe we need to go up and spend the summer up there instead of in Miami or Columbia, South Carolina or whatever. And, you know, when people started coming up and spending a little bit of summertime, they eventually got up on Grandfather, where the virgin forest of the mountain was probably, according to early documents, the most spectacular virgin forest in the entire southeastern United States.
Yeah, I mean, the time that I was coming up there as a kid, as a little kid, was like the mid-50s and late 50s. And, you know, it was almost ridiculous. You'd run into kids you knew from school, the kid you sat next to in your third grade class or whatever. You'd run into them in the streets of, you know, Blowing Rock or something. And but that was like before air conditioning became common. It was very common for people to run from the heat and get up to the mountains. But going back further, you know, when did the first visitors arrive who were basically tourists, you know, kind of looking for outdoor adventure and enjoyment, and what were accommodations like for them? How did they get around? What was that whole situation like then, and when was that?
Actually, there wasn't a lot of recreational exploration prior to the Civil War. Literally, one of the earliest was a fellow named Jehu Lewis, who wrote a story in the Atlantic Monthly right after the Civil War. And when people like that came up here, they didn't stay in hotels and motels. They stayed with the local mountaineers. It was a tradition that if someone presented themselves and they were walking through the mountains or riding a horse through the mountains, if you were the only place they could stay, then you know you had to invite them in. In fact, Charles Dudley Warner actually the co-author with Mark Twain of that book, The Gilded Age. He was here in the early 1880s. He and his traveling partner, they had to stay in whatever log cabins, you know, they could find. It was pretty rough.
That's funny, the idea of, you know, just kind of walking up on a cabin in the deep woods where they've hardly even seen any outsider ever in their lives, and you're knocking the door and say, it's kind of like very early Airbnb, but without prior arrangement. Can we stay for the night? My gosh, and, you know, I've been reading a book by a fellow named Horace Kephart that was published in 1913 called Our Southern Highlanders, and it's about the mountain people. He calls them mountaineers, but it's about these people who lived up in the mountains back then and were so isolated, and, you know, he describes their living conditions, which were, you know, I mean, almost squalid at best, basically like a very small one-room cabin, you know, with all kind of, you know, gaps between the logs letting in the freezing air and everything, and so these people weren't used to seeing outsiders, and, you know, were very suspicious of them, so that's a strange concept that somebody who's relatively wealthy looking and talking to them would walk up and knock on the door and ask if they could spend the night, but that would actually happen, huh?
It certainly would. And in fact, I heartily recommend that book, Our Southern Highlanders. It's spectacular. I do reference it in my book. And in fact, Court, what you're talking about now, about what that experience was like of this area of the Grandfather Mountain and the Appalachian area, what that was like back in the 1800s, I try to go into real depth with deep, deep research and not academic research. You know, I try to communicate the real experience of that by looking back at many of the people who did it and quoting them. So there's a lot of research in this book, but it's not an academic book at all. It's very much trying to celebrate the mountain people and, you know, look back at just how much these areas have changed. I mean, Grandfather Mountain, it may be the most singular mountain in the South, but it's also a mountain that has helped create the resort communities of Boone, Blowing Rock, Linville, Banner Elk. The history of Grandfather Mountain is really the history of this entire high country area. And by the time you get finished reading this book, I think you've seen the history and sensed the reality of the entire Appalachian mountain chain. I tell that story of the Appalachians through the eyes of the great evergreen grandfather, the grandfather of the Appalachians.
Well, I think that's true, Randy. And the book, again, is Grandfather Mountain, The History and Guide to an Appalachian Icon by Randy Johnson. As you describe, it's a very very broad and very readable book. You know, what I didn't realize until just a few years ago, most of the mountain was privately owned by one family, and in modern times by one man, which is kind of extraordinary given a mountain that's 40 miles long, all told, or something. So tell us how that came about, just kind of briefly without, you know, the entire genealogy of it, but how did it happen that ultimately one man in modern times owned this humongous, iconic mountain?
In the late 1800s, again, the wealthy McCrae family of Wilmington, they were looking around to start a resort community. I mean, the trend toward vacationing in the mountains had started, and these were developers as well. They wanted to do some logging, they wanted to do some mining, and the McCrae family purchased 16,000 acres around Grandfather Mountain, and as time went on, the mountain was logged. There was the little resort town of Linville, as we say up here, was created, one of the first planned communities in the country, like the mountain town of Highlands in southwestern North Carolina. So basically, ultimately, the McCrae family became the Morton family as time went on. And Hugh Morton, when he came back from World War II, he inherited Grandfather Mountain from his early McCrae ancestors. And he started the modern development of the mountain with, you know, the Mile High Swinging Bridge and the Mildred the Bear environmental habitats. Actually, in the 1930s, there was the first road that would take you partway up the mountain for great views. Ultimately, and I think luckily, in 2009, the Morton family sold the vast bulk of Grandfather Mountain to the state. Today, it's a state park, and there's still a small acreage up there that is privately owned. It's operated as a stewardship foundation. You can still walk across the swinging bridge, but but it's a smaller part of the mountain. Now, thankfully, the vast bulk of Grandfather Mountain is preserved and in perpetuity.
Yeah, that's good. And in fact, probably having one person, one family own it may have protected it from some of the logging that I think we'll talk about a little later in the show here. But it needed protection because there were virgin forests there, primeval forests that had never been cut. And that was increasingly rare. I think there's almost none of it left in the U.S. now. So you mentioned the McRae family, who were Scottish extraction, and they were actually Scottish people from Scotland, not just Scotch-Irish settlers. And people like them were central to the development of the Grandfather Mountain area, as you kind of described briefly there. Were there any others besides McRae who were Scots people who were, ended up in this area and were instrumental in the history of the mountain?
Absolutely. One of the most fascinating stories, I think, is that when Hugh McRae, the Wilmington McRae family, when he first bought the mountain and came up here, believe it or not, there was another McRae living literally near Linville in these beautiful meadows under Grandfather Mountain. His name was Alexander McRae, Alec McRae. And he indeed was a recent immigrant from Scotland. These McRaes ultimately traced their clan roots back to kind of the same place, but it's just hard to believe that there were two McRae, separate McRae families. And the McRae family from Scotland directly, the Alec McRae family, he was a bagpiper, for heaven's sake. And he was known throughout the area for Scottish culture. And so the Grandfather Mountain Highland Games was started by Hugh Morton's mother in 1956. But think about that. 80 years before the Grandfather Mountain Highland Games were formed, there was a Scottish immigrant playing bagpipes in the same meadows where the games are held today.
Yeah, that's amazing. So the Scottish people are not just just thrifty, as the classic reputation goes, but they're also energetic and industrious, and they kind of hit this area like a buzzsaw and had a lot to do with the founding of some of the resorts that you mentioned that, you know, were tiny at the time, but became real well-known and much bigger, Blowing Rock and Boone and Linville, as you mentioned. So just very briefly, did they found those towns or, you know, start hotels? How did they do that?
Well, I don't think they founded those towns. There were a lot of Scots-Irish people here to begin with, as well as people who moved in to that budding tourism industry. But let's go back to Alexander McRae for a moment. You know, when Linville was started, it was a very small, isolated place. How could you get there? The Tweedsie Railroad from Johnson City, Tennessee, had not been created at that time. There was one popular tourist town near Linville, near Grandfather, and that was Blowing Rock. It was a very successful place. So what did Alexander McRae do? He worked with his local mountaineer partners, and they literally designed and built a highway all the way from Linville all the way to Blowing Rock. And that highway is still in use today as US 221 around the eastern side of Grandfather, mm-hmm. right below the Blue Ridge Parkway. It was known as one of the most famously well-built roads in the mountains, and to this day it still is. It winds all over the place, but it's very level. It was probably the most modern highway in the mountains at that time. And in fact, it was probably the first really scenic road that was built from a tourism perspective, years before the Blue Ridge Parkway was ever thought of.
You know, so we mentioned a while ago, logging. Into the first part of the 20th century, you know, as we said, these forests around Grandfather were mostly virgin. And you describe in your book, the trees were so tall and dense that there was very little undergrowth and hikers could just walk where they wanted without even a trail. But then came the logging on a scale you call environmental Armageddon. So we don't have a whole lot of time left, but just tell us how that went, that whole logging phase around that area.
Well, it was indeed the private landowners of Grandfather, the McRae family, later the Morton family, that did log the mountain. The northern part of the mountain, what was called the North Woods, just the most spectacular virgin forest in the south, was actually logged by a railroad, just like many places in the Smokies and elsewhere. And that kind of logging is extremely destructive. Luckily, when the very highest part of the mountain was logged, there was an easier hand taken with that. They logged the mountain with horse-drawn teams to pull the logs down. That did far, far less damage. So luckily, Grandfather Mountain's very special ecosystems were able to recover and were able to survive. In fact, Court, that's really one of the most important things to me. Grandfather Mountain is now known as the most ecologically significant mountain in all of Eastern America. It's not just an icon of the tourism industry in the Appalachians, but an icon of the rich environment we have in the Appalachians with so much plant diversity, so many diverse species. And luckily, the logging didn't eradicate all that. So we lucked out. We dodged a bullet with that, that's for sure.
You know, we've mentioned the Blue Ridge Parkway a few times. I think it's the most visited park in the national park system, right? I mean, we don't have much time to talk about it here, but is that part true?
No, that is true. And I would argue that Grandfather Mountain is the peak of the Blue Ridge Parkway experience, especially with that winding Linco Viaduct span that soars around the mountainside. Mm. It's awesome. It's awesome.
Yep, it's true. Anybody's ever driven on it any time of the year, but especially during the peak color in the fall, it's really spectacular. So how did you get involved, and you've been involved for most of your adult life, I think, in the life of the mountain? And what have your roles been, just kind of briefly? We just have a minute or so left.
I found Grandfather Mountain for myself, and then one day when I went back, the trails were closed. A hiker had died from hypothermia up there, and Hugh Morton, the owner, had put up no trespassing signs. I didn't want the mountain to be off limits to the public, so I met with him. I persuaded him that I could manage the mountain and keep people safe. He hired me to do that, and ultimately that management system that I started lasted all the way up until the state park was created. It's pretty much the same management up there today as it was then, I guess. And, you know, my roles have changed. I eventually left the mountain, became a magazine editor and writer, but right now I'm still the trail manager for the Mountains to Sea Trail on the eastern side of Grandfather Mountain.
Oh, that's great. Well, it's been a really fulfilling thing to have centered your life around, I'm sure. So the last 75 pages of Randy's book comprise part two, A Practical Guide to Hiking and Photography, which is just like it sounds. It's both useful and beautiful, full of photos. I mean, every page has a couple of photos on it that are all striking and a lot of interesting information. And the book, again, is called Grandfather Mountain, The History and Guide to an Appalachian Icon. Author is Randy Johnson, who's been our guest here today. It won first place in the books category of the Society of American Travel Writers Eastern Chapter Awards, so it's an award-winning book. It's won some other awards as well. You can buy the book at Amazon and all the usual places, or even better, check your local independent bookstore, and a lot of them will have it, or if they don't, they can order it. Randy's website is randyjohnsonbooks.com, where you can see more of what we've been talking about here, randyjohnsonbooks.com. Well, Randy, it's been interesting and fascinating talking with you about Grandfather Mountain, which so many people know about, and now we know more about. Appreciate you being on with us.
Thank you for having me, Court.
And thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.